And I'm sorry,
Well,
Erev Tov, everybody. Yeah. It's no introduction needed. Parshat Chayisara coming up this week. So, Vakasha.
Okay. The question is why different traditions frequently, often, sometimes, rarely have differences in Haftarot. I suggest that the way to address this is I will make a point in some subsequent week in which there is such a difference. I'll make a point of addressing it. I think that will be a better answer to the question than something that's just speculative. Okay, so let me get the screen started. And here we go. Okay, so some of you may recall from a previous evening that I like to take the road not taken, speculate on what, look, it's good. It's, you know, it's a good follow-up to the question. I mean, if there are differences between Ashkenazim, Sfaradim, Temanim, and Chabadniks, then, you know, why shouldn't there be additional differences? So I did speculate on a previous occasion as to what might have been an alternative Haftarah. So I thought that I would share with you my speculation on this week, not because it's a realistic alternative, but because it'll do, nevertheless give us some insight into the Sidra. The Sidra of Chaye Sarah opens with the episode in which our matriarch Sarah dies and our patriarch Abraham has to acquire a burial plot for her. And he succeeds after negotiations with the Hittite residents of Hebron, and particularly one of their number named Ephron the Hittite. And he succeeds in acquiring not just an immediate need, that is a burial plot for Mother Sarah, but he succeeds in acquiring what turns into a perpetual tomb. Parenthetically, you may know that there is some Jewish legends that say that when Abraham buried Sarah in the double cave in Hebron, that the cave already was occupied. Sarah was not its first occupant. It was already occupied by Adam and Eve. So if it was already the burial place of Adam and Eve, difficult really to understand why it belonged to Ephron the Hittite. And if it belonged to Ephron the Hittite, I don't understand why he was prepared to part with it, even for what may or may not have been the princely sum of 400 silver shekels. If I had the tomb of Adam and Eve in my possession, I wouldn't relinquish it for anything. Just imagine what you could rake in for the concessions, let alone for the admission fees. In any event, it does start with that episode. And there is a parallel to it, not in one of the books of the Nevi'im, so it could not serve as a Haftarah, even if I had my way, so to speak. But it does have a parallel in a retelling in Divrei HaYamim, in one of the books of Chronicles, of an episode that is narrated for the first time at the very end of the second book of Samuel. You may recall towards the very end of the second book of Samuel that there is a plague that strikes the land of Israel. And at the end of the plague, David wants to offer sacrifices in order to atone for whatever it was that caused the plague in the first place. And he's instructed to offer the sacrifices in a particular place, a place that was occupied at that time by the granary or the threshing floor that belonged to a particular Jebusite named or entitled Aravna. And David acquires from Aravna, the Jebusite, he acquires from him the site of his granary or threshing floor, and that eventually becomes the site on which David's son Solomon builds the temple in Jerusalem. So according to the story in Shmuel, David's purchase of the Gorem of Aravna HaYevusi sets the stage, so to speak, for Shlomo HaMelech's building of the Beit HaMikdash. But the interesting thing, and we're going to focus this evening on the question of repetitions, when that story that appears at the end of Shmuel Bet is repeated in towards the end of the first book of Divrei HaYamim, you can see with the highlighted passages that it's as though the authors or editors of Divrei HaYamim made a deliberate and concerted effort to have David's acquisition of the Goren of Aravna match literally Abraham's acquisition of the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. In both cases, we find that the purchaser addresses the seller, requesting his consent for the acquisition of the property. And David says to Aravna or Ornan, "Tena li mekom hagorem," right? Give me the site of the granary or threshing floor. "Ve'evnebo mizbeach l'Hashem," because I need to construct an altar. "Bechesef malei tenehu li," give it to me or cede it to me in exchange for its full value in cash. "V'te'atzer ha-magefa me'al ha'am," so that the plague will come to an end. And that parallels not only in substance but in form Avraham's address to the Hittites, asking them to intercede on his behalf with Ephron the Hittite. And Avraham says, "V'yitenli," notice again the term of nitina, of giving, rather than mechira, selling. "V'yitenli et ma'arat ha-machpelah asher lo asher b'ktzei sadehu," and the identical phrase, "Bechesef male yitnen nali betochechem la'achuzat kaver." So as I said, since Avraham was the one who said it first, it does appear as though the authors or editors of Divrei HaYamim wanted David HaMelech's acquisition of the Goren of Aravna to parallel Avraham's acquisition of the Me'arat HaMachpelah. And we find it in the continuation also. I don't want to spend too much time on it. If you look at the Pasuk Kaf Dalet in the right-hand column, David subsequently says to Ornan, to Aravna, who offers it to him for free, again, reminiscent of the behavior of the Hittites and Ephron vis-a-vis Abraham. "Vayomer HaMelech David l'Ornan, lo, I'm not going to accept it as a gift. Ki, rather, kano ekne bechesef malei." Once again, repeating that phrase of kesef malei. And finally, "Vayiten David l'Ornan b'makom," on the spot David gave Ornan, "shiklei zahav mishkal shesh me'ot," 600 golden shekalim, cash on the barrel. Parallel again to Avraham's acquisition of the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, "Vayishkol Avraham le'efron et ha'kesef asher diber bo'oznei v'nechei, 400 shekel kesef over la'socher." So again, as I said, it's not that I'm suggesting that this perek of Divrei HaYamim should substitute as the Haftarah for Chaye Sarah, but it certainly shows us, gives us some insight into how biblical stories are retold in later books of the Bible. Okay. By the way, the reason I think that the authors or editors of Divrei HaYamim took this approach to the acquisition of the Goren of Aravna is because the Goren of Aravna and the Ma'arat HaMachpelah have something in common. It's something that they share in common with only one other, a third piece of real estate in the land of Israel. And that is that there are three pieces of real estate in the land of Israel, which were acquired by purchase by our ancestors. Abraham bought the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. Jacob purchased from the residence of Shechem, a place in which Joseph was eventually buried, a field near Shechem that became the tomb of Joseph. And here we have David HaMelech purchasing the Goren of Aravna HaYavusi, on which the Beit HaMikdash was built. And this did not escape the notice of our rabbis. We have here a little passage from the Midrash Breshit Rabbah that ties them all together. Rabbi Yudan Bar Simon says, Zeh, that is to say, this, the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, is one of three places, Shlosha Mekomot, She'ein Umot HaOlam Yecholin Lehonot Et Yisrael, of which, about which, the nations of the world cannot taunt the Jewish people, Lomar, accusing them of Gezulim Hem Biyadchem, of having stolen these plots of land. And the Eluhain, and these are the three places, the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the Beit HaMikdash, that is to say, the Goren of Aravna, on which the Beit HaMikdash was built, and that field adjacent to Shechem that Yaakov bought, however much that was, which in which Joseph was eventually entombed. Okay, that's the road not taken. Now let's go back let's transition to the road that actually was taken. And here's the transition. We find already in a 16th century work, Commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, we already find a list of haftarot with matching them to the Siddarim, or the parashiyot, to which they are connected. Okay, and in this text, it says, Parashat Chayei Sarah, Maftirin, V'Hamelech David Zaken Baba Yamim. Right, that the haftarah for Chayei Sarah is the very beginning, the very opening verse of the first half of the Book of Kings, that describes King David as being zaken, elderly, baba yamim, advanced in age. Shehu me'ena parasha. And it goes even further, and it tells us why this is connected to Chayei Sarah, because in Chayei Sarah, at the beginning of chapter 24 of Bereshit, it says, Va'Avraham zaken baba yamim. Abraham was elderly and advanced in age. So it appears, at least according to the Levush, according to Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe, that the connection between the Haftarah and the Sidra is the connection between two elderly Jewish gentlemen, Abraham on the one end, David on the other, who are described in identical terms as being zekenim, elderly, and ba'im ba'yamim, advanced in age. To which I respond by saying, okay, if we're looking for a passage from one of the books of the Nevi'im, in which there's simply a notation to the effect that somebody was elderly and advanced in age, I offer you two alternatives, both referring to Joshua, one at the beginning of chapter 13 in the book that bears his name, and one at the beginning of chapter 23, which is almost the very end of the book of Joshua, in both of which Joshua is described as zaken baba yamim, elderly and advanced in years. So why not choose them? Well, the answer is because there's more to it than just a three-word association. And with that, we come to the haftarah of this week's Sidra, which consists of most but not all of the first chapter of the first part of the Book of Kings. It's all about King David. And it tells us, as we already know and anticipated, Vamelech David Zaken Baba Yamim. King David was elderly and advanced in age. Bear in mind, by the way, because we will, when we get through with the Haftarah, we'll talk about both the similarities and differences between the descriptions and activities of Abraham as an elderly man and of King David as an elderly man. And the first thing that we should simply note was that King David's old age comes nowhere near Abraham's, okay? King David died at the age of 70, right? Remind you, at the age of 70, Abraham was first leaving, right? First making Aliyah, okay? Abraham lived more than another 70 years beyond that. So when Abraham is described as a Zaken Baba Yamin, Abraham was really old. When David was described as a Zaken and Baba Yamin, he was, as we'll read in just a moment, obviously quite old and frail, right? But certainly not a comparison to Abraham. So the Pasuk tells us, perhaps, in spite of the fact that David at this moment in time was only 70 years old, Vayechasuhu babegadim v'lo yechamlo, he was covered with clothes. Doesn't mean, you know, clothes necessarily. Begadim could refer as well to what we call blankets or robes or things like that. V'lo yechamlo, but he could not, he was still cold. So we're told that at whatever age David was at this moment in time, he clearly was not the vigorous, you know, vibrant David of his youth, whom we know as the David who went and slew Goliath, as the David who led the armies of Israel on unmatched conquests of territory. Clearly, this was an elderly and very frail David, a mere shadow of what he once was. So his servants are concerned about the king's health. So they come up with a rather original way of solving the king's problem of constantly being cold. And their solution is, let there be sought for my lord the king a young virgin. Let her stand before the king and be a companion to him. Let her lie in thy bosom that my lord the king may get heat. So indeed, we're told that they searched throughout Israel and they found, believe it or not, a fair damsel. When was the last time you actually heard of a search for or the discovery of a fair damsel? Kind of like comes out of Robin Hood, okay? So this is not the, you know, this is not the current Jewish Publication Society translation. This is the old 1917 Jewish Publication Society translation that was adopted as well by Sansino Press. So it's kind of more, you know, old-fashioned than you would expect to find today. So they sought and found a fair damsel named Avishag, who came from a place called Shunam. You may remember it from last week's Haftarah, okay? And she is described as being Yafa Ad Ma'od, as being singularly or exceptionally beautiful. Vatehi LaMelech Sochenet, she served as a Sochenet to the king. Vateshartehu, and she ministered to him. VaHamelech Lo Yida'ah. But in spite of what we might have been led to leave by the somewhat suggestive language that was used previously, the king did not, in a biblical sense, know her. Okay. This is Act 1 in this week's Haftarah. It's an introduction to get us to appreciate the extent to which King David was, as I described him, only a shadow of his former self. This comes to the fore now in the continuation. And that is that King David has, as we know from the end of the second book of Samuel, numerous children from numerous wives. One of those wives was named Chagit, and one of her sons was named Adoniah. Now, when she named him Adoniah, I don't know whether she had anything particular in mind, but the fact that this Adoniah, right, the word Adon meaning a lord or a master, that this Adoniah sets himself up to be the Adon, the king, the ruler, the sovereign of the Jewish people, is certainly something to take note of. So this Adoniah ben Chagit, mitnaseh, raised himself up, exalted himself, lemor, saying, ani emloch, I will succeed my father David. And he not only makes this declaration, right, not only as it were tweets about it, but he goes ahead and he does something about it. He prepares for himself chariots and horsemen and chamishim ish ratzim lefanav. He actually hires 50 men who simply run ahead of him, probably saying, here comes Adoniyahu. Okay. Now, what's David's reaction to this? David's reaction is not inconsistent with what we now know to be David's frail situation. And that is lo atzavo aviv mi'amav lemor madua. King David never rebuked him, never remonstrated with him. You see the translation here of his father had not grieved him. So maybe in slightly more modern English, but using the same idiom, we would say his father never gave him grief over his activities. Never asked him, madua kacha asita, why are you behaving like this? And then we're told in addition, v'gamhu, that is Adoniyahu, tov toar ma'od, was strikingly handsome. V'oto yalida acharei Avshalom. And he was a full brother to Avshalom. Now, once you mention Avshalom's name in this context, you already hear it's resonant with the recollection that who was Avshalom? Avshalom was one of David's sons who not only would have set himself up to succeed his father, but actually set himself up to rebel against his father and to replace him. So whether that's the way they were brought up by their mother Chagit, or whether there's some other explanation, maybe it was nurture rather than nature, I don't know. But it's significant that Adoniyahu, we are told, was not only a handsome fellow who might attract a following, not only apparently charismatic, but may also have learned a lesson or so from his late brother Avshalom. So he might have wanted to follow in Avshalom's footsteps, but was reluctant to actually declare himself while David could still do something about it. But now that clearly David is no longer in a position to do anything about it, he has, so to speak, made it public. And now we see that they choose up sides. So of course, simply to make it easy to tell the good guys from the bad guys, and since I can't paint white hats and black hats over all of the characters, I simply chose the colors red and green. Green, of course, for go and the good guys, and red for stop and the bad guys. So we can see the teams that are being set up here. Adoniyahu takes counsel with Yoav ben Tzruya, who was David's four-star general in charge of the army, v'im Evyatar HaKohen, with one of the two most prominent Kohanim of the time, and they, Yoav and Evyatar, are described as having assisted Adoniyahu. Okay. On the other hand, another Kohen named Tzadok and another one of David's warriors, Benayahu ben Yehoyada, as well as Natan the Navi and others of David's stalwart companions named Shimei and Rei, okay, they are described as lo hayuim Adoniyahu. So we already see that they're choosing up sides. There are amongst not only the populace of Israel, but amongst the leading lights of Israel, there are those who are siding with Adoniyahu, and there are those who make a point of not taking Adoniyahu's side. So Adoniyahu now presses further, and he makes a big party, and look who he invites to his party. He invites, again, highlighted in red, all of the princelings, right? And he also invites all of Avdei HaMelech, I don't want to call them, the civil service. Okay? So obviously, he is inviting them to his party in order to get them to declare their allegiance to him. And we're told again rather pointedly, and so far all we have are these oppositional things, that Natan the prophet, Benayahu the warrior, the others of David's companions, and Shlomo were not invited. Okay. Parenthetically, I'm kind of curious. If you look back in verse 8, we're told that that another one of the people who did not side with Adoniyahu was Tzadok, the Kohen. We see that Adoniyahu made a point of not inviting Natan the prophet, Benayahu of the Giborim, and Shlomo. It doesn't specifically say that he didn't invite Tzadok the Kohen. So I might push the point and say, well, was he invited? So I suspect that the answer is no, he wasn't invited, and that there's no need to tell me that he wasn't invited. Just there's no need to tell me that his counterpart, Evyatar, might not have been invited, simply because probably Kohanim were not invited to these kinds of things. These were probably parties more in the sense of where people ate too much, may have drunk too much, and it really isn't the place where you want a, you know, a Kohen present. Just speculation. But we go on. We go on to the next act, in which offstage, the prophet Natan gives advice to Bathsheba, mother of Solomon, right? And he says to Bathsheba, Halo shama'at ki malach Adoniyahu ven chagit. Have you heard that Adoniyahu has already, well, literally it says that he is already reigning, but it might just as well mean that he has declared himself to be the king. Vadoneno David lo yada, and I assure you, says Natan, David is oblivious. So what does he advise Bathsheba to do? He says, I'm going to give you the following advice, and this advice is very good advice because it's going to enable you and Solomon, you'll be able to escape. Maltiat nafshech vet nefesh b'nech Shlomo. Okay? Meaning, if we fail in this, your life and Shlomo's life are in jeopardy. Okay? Adoniyahu surely is not going to allow his rival, his potential rival, to survive. So what does he tell her in verse 13? He tells her, he scripts her. He says, come to the king and say to him as follows. Halo ata Adoni HaMelech, my lord, you nishbata lamatcha lemor, you took an oath to me, right, to Bathsheba, lemor, saying, Shlomo v'nechim lo chacharai, I will be succeeded by Solomon. Hu yeshev al kisi, he's the one who's going to sit on the throne. Madua malach Adoniyahu, why is Adoniyahu proclaiming himself king? But this isn't the end of the advice. He adds one more piece, he says. Hineodach medaberet shamim hamelach. And while you're still talking to the king, ani avo acharayich, I'm going to enter the presence of the king. I'm going to follow you. Umileti et divarayich. And I am going to fill in, as it were, the blanks. And indeed, that's the next scene in which Bathsheba comes to the king. And I'm going to, I hope you can see, yes, you probably can. You can see, make it just a little bit smaller so you can see the whole. Okay, you can see here the parallels. You can see in the upper part of the screen the words that that Natan scripted for Bathsheba. And in the lower part of the screen, you can see verbatim Bathsheba's speech before the king. And you can see that Bathsheba is following the script. But there are some deviations. And that's worth talking about because, again, as I said, one of our themes for this evening is repetition. Okay? So take a look. You see the two passages that are underlined in yellow. And you see that within those two otherwise identical quotations, there are a bunch of words that are underlined in brown, gold. Why not? In gold. Okay? And that's the difference. See the difference? The script that Natan wrote for Bathsheba was to have her remind David that he had taken an oath. Bathsheba, when she speaks to David, says that you took an oath, Bashem Elohecha, that you took a solemn oath. You took an oath using the name of God, a sacrosanct oath. Obviously, Bathsheba is strengthening it. It's not an ordinary oath. It's not that David said to Bathsheba, oh, yeah, Solomon, he'll be the king. Yeah, I promise, right? No, you took a solemn oath as though you actually put your hand on a Bible. Right? That's the equivalent of Nishbata Bashem Elohecha. You, as it were, put your hand on the Bible, raised your left hand, and took an oath saying that Solomon will be my successor. Now, in the very next act, Natan, as he promised, comes along, right? And he follows up Bathsheba's address to the king. We'll go back in a moment, but I want you to see the parallel here. Look again at the sentence that's underlined in yellow, and look again at the single word that's highlighted in gold. Natan speaks to the king and he says, you said, Adoniyahu yimloch acharai v'hu yeshev al kis'i. See this, right? In the original script, let's go back for a moment. The original script that Natan himself wrote had David swearing, taking an oath. Bathsheba strengthened it, right? By saying not even an ordinary oath, a sacred oath. And yet when it comes Natan's turn, not only does he not use Bathsheba's language of a solemn, sacred oath, he doesn't even call it an oath anymore. He calls it, you said. Why do you think that this is just an accident of the biblical narrator, that having already told us twice that it was an oath, just said, I don't have to say anymore that it was an oath. Everybody knows that already. I'll just use the word amarta. Not likely. What's more likely is that this is supposed to tell us something about Natan's frame of mind at this moment. I think it tells us something very important about the entire episode. One thing that we don't know about what we've read so far is whether it was true that King David had taken an oath to Bathsheba that Solomon would be his successor. You know, you may recall, at the very end of the book of Bereshit, when Jacob dies, his brothers, Joseph's brothers, approach him and they say, Avicha tziva lifnei moto. that our father, before he passed away, left as part of his last will and testament that you should forgive us for our hand in your sale to Egypt. And Jacob and Joseph acquiesces, and he tells his brothers that he holds them no grudge. But there is no pasuk that tells us that Jacob actually said that. We simply have to judge the truth of that statement on the basis of whatever evidence there is, or on the basis of whatever assumptions we have already made about Joseph and Joseph's brothers and the extent to which they tell the truth or the extent to which they stretch the truth. Same thing here. Nathan has Bathsheba go in and say to King David, "You swore." But there is no record of such an oath, which raises the possibility that maybe King David never had made such an oath. And maybe that's what we're supposed to deduce from the fact that when Nathan comes in to speak to the king, all of a sudden he's a little hesitant, he's reluctant. He's not even going to say, "Ata nishba'ata," let alone "Ata nishba'ata b'Hashem Elohecha." Maybe the reason that he says "Ata amarta" is because he thinks that Bathsheba has gone too far in trying to make this not only into something that David should live up to because he's a man of his word and should keep his promises, but making it as though if he didn't see to this, somehow he was violating a sacred oath. Possible. I don't know. In any event, okay. Here again in Bathsheba's address to David, we see again, you can see from the red and the green underlines, right, whose names are brought into the conversation. And the same thing again in Nathan's follow-up to Bathsheba, the same names are brought into the conversation. You do notice, however, there's also something underlined in purple. And that is Nathan to give emphasis to the fact that this requires a timely decision and timely action on David's part, says people are already shouting from the rooftops, "Yay Adoniyahu," right? "Yechi HaMelech Adoniyahu." Notice, Bathsheba had done the same thing. She had said to David, "Va'ata hinei Adoniyahu malach." And that's somewhat reminiscent of the fact that in Nathan's earlier instructions to Bathsheba, he had told her to say, "Madua malach Adoniyahu." And all of that takes us very back to the beginning of all of this, when we were first introduced to Adoniyahu, who was mitnaseh, elevating himself by saying, "Ani emloch." So "Ani emloch" is not just an expression of will or an expression of desire on his part, which it often is in biblical Hebrew. Very often people are described as saying something where there is no expectation or indication that they articulated it. It could simply mean that that's what they were thinking at that moment in time. But here it seems to be more than just a thought, because it seems to resonate throughout the episode. Okay. And what happens next? What happens next is the end of the story, and that is the king's declaration. Okay, Vayan HaMelech David, right? King David, in response now to the combined petitions of Bathsheba and Nathan, makes a declaration, right? Kiruli levat shava vatavo lifnei HaMelech vatamod lifnei HaMelech. He summons Bathsheba back into his presence. Vayishava hamelech vayomar chai Hashem. If he hadn't taken a solemn oath before, he sure is taking a solemn oath now. And the substance of the oath is, Kasher nishbati lach b'shem Elohei Yisrael lemor. So if we had up until now a toss-up, who was right, Bathsheba or Natan? Was it not merely an oath, but an oath b'shem Elohecha? Or was it simply amarta, just a promise that he had uttered? We now have King David's own testimony validating Bathsheba's petition and telling us that indeed at some previous point in time, although unrecorded in Tanakh, he had indeed taken an oath of the very nature that was described three times previously. Ki Shlomo v'neich yimloch acharai, Solomon will succeed me, v'yeshev al kis'i tachtai, and he will inherit my throne. And Bathsheba responds by prostrating herself on the ground in front of the king, and in the very spirit of the Yechi Adoniyahu that we saw chanted by the mobs previously, she now recites Yechi Adoni HaMelech David, and she adds a fascinating word at the end, Le'olam. Why does she add Le'olam? Does she really think that David had found the fountain of youth and was going to live forever? She couldn't see with her own eyes what had become of King David, of the stalwart King David, who now, I mean, wrapped up in his favorite, you know, flannel robe and fleece sweater, still was shivering? No. But it would be very, very bad protocol. It would be very undiplomatic for her at this moment to remind the king of his frailty, to remind the king of his fragility, as though to say, you're on your way out, old man, and Solomon is just waiting on the other side of the threshold to take your place. Very, very unbecoming. Therefore, I think that she makes quite a point at the end of saying, Yechi Adoni HaMelech David Le'olam. Hey, I appreciate your oath. I appreciate your verifying, your confirmation of this, your public confirmation of Solomon as your successor, right? But, you know, lang lebensolsdo, you know, you just live so long. And here, of course, is where the Haftarah comes to an end. Haftarah comes to an end, but the Shiur doesn't. As I mentioned at the beginning, this was chosen as the Haftarah because of the obvious points of comparison. The obvious points of comparison between Abraham and King David, as the both are relatively elderly patriarchs concerned about their legacies. Abraham's concern finds expression in his painstaking instructions about a suitable bride for Isaac. David's concern finds expression in his declaration of Solomon as a suitable successor. Curiously, in both cases, the patriarch overlooks an alternative, an older sibling. Abraham neglects Ishmael, and David overrules Adoniyahu in favor of Solomon. But there are also striking differences, and perhaps these two were in the mind of whoever made the choice of this Haftarah. Abraham, in spite of his age, is in full possession of all of his faculties. David, as we've seen, was greatly enfeebled. Abraham takes the initiative in sending his major domo to seek a bride for Isaac. David is incapable of initiative. He responds to others' initiatives. In the whole story of major domo's odyssey, Isaac makes only one appearance, and that is as Ben Adoni, my master's son. Isaac, we might add, as all we've known about him since the Akedah, is perennially passive, submissive. Adoniyahu, quite to the contrary, seizes the initiative and acts even contrary to his father's wishes. The atmosphere about Abraham and his tent is one of tranquility. The atmosphere of David in the royal palace is fraught with tension. And these similarities and the contrasts as well are brought out through the Haftarah. And this too was noticed by our rabbis, who in this Midrash in the Yalkut Shimoni tell us a point to the fact that King David and the patriarch Abraham are in a certain respect models of two men who merited their advanced age because they acted in a manner that the Tanakh describes as being righteous. Of Abraham, it says that God says that I know that he has instructed his household, Vishamru derech Hashem la'asot tzedaka u'mishpat, that to observe God's ways and to act righteously and justly. And of King David, it was said, V'David osem mishpat u'tzedaka l'chol amo, that King David too acted justly and righteously with all of his subjects. And that, according to the Midrash, is why these two characters merited to be described as having reached a ripe old age, even though, as we said, there was a considerable discrepancy between them. One final point, and that relates to repetition as a literary technique. The single most repetitive element in Tanakh is in this week's Sidra. When we hear the story of Eved Avraham as he imagines it, and then we hear it again from the scriptural narrator as it actually unfolds in real time, and then as that were not enough, we hear portions of it yet again as the Eved Avraham retells the story in the presence of the young woman and her family. This is just one of the Gilyonot of Nechama Leibovitz, in which she just simply matched up some of the corresponding elements in the story. And again, if you download this, you will have it. And otherwise, you can just go to nechama.org.il, and that's the website that has gives you access to all of the Gilyonot of Nechama Leibovitz. But I want to look just at the end at one single item in it. I want to focus on the gifts that the servant bestows upon the young woman. Compare the following verses and note the discrepancy. In verses 22 to 24, which is the Torah's third person narrative, right? What's unfolding in so-called real time, it says that when the camels finished drinking, the man, that is to say the servant, took a golden ring and two bracelets, placed them upon the hands of Rebecca, and then asked her, by the way, who are you? To which she replied, I'm Rebecca. In verse 47, when he's retelling the story to Rebecca and her family, it says, I asked her, Bat Miat, who are you? And she said, I'm Rebecca, the daughter of Betuel. So I placed the ring in her nose and the bracelets upon her hands. So there's the question for you. Which is true? Did he first question her identity and then give her gifts? Or did he first give her the gifts and only then belatedly inquire of her identity? Now, doesn't really matter which medieval exegete said what, because obviously there is a difference of opinion amongst them. And here you have it. Rashi says that the truth is that he gave her the gifts before asking her identity. Why is Rashi so sure about that? Because that's the way the Torah narrates it. And Rashi gives more credibility to the Torah than he gives to Avraham's servant. Avraham's servant is capable of prevaricating, twisting the truth, as Rashi maintains, right? That he reversed the order in speaking to the young lady's family. Why? Because he didn't want to be tripped up by his own words, lest they ask him, how could you have given her gifts without even knowing who she was? Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, looks at it just the opposite. And he says that it seems to him that when the servant was telling the story to Rebecca and her family, he was telling the truth. He first asked her who she was, and then gave her the gifts. So why is it not narrated that way? And here we get a big clue into how sophisticated Rashbam was in contrast to Rashi as a reader of scriptural narrative. And that is that Rashbam says that in order not to interrupt their conversation, the Torah narrates the gift giving first. That the order in which the Torah presents things is not always and not necessarily the absolute sequential order. Sometimes objective sequence has to take a back seat to narrative art. And that too is a lesson of repetition, as we saw it in the Haftarah as well. And that basically brings us to the end. Let me take a quick look at some of the comments here and see if we need to heralds. Heralds, how many did typical king have? I don't know what a typical king is. I'm not sure where you get the heralds in Megillat Esther. The term that's used in Megillat Esther when Mordecai is to be dressed up in the king's robes and driven around in the royal limousine, so to speak, it says v'kar'u lefanav avrech. No, that's Joseph. I'm sorry. Joseph, v'kar'u lefanav avrech. With Mordecai, it's kacha ye'aseh la'ish asher ha'melech chafetz bi'karo. So, I guess in a sense that would be a kind of heraldry. It would be a kind of heraldry. Yeah. That yes. Good point then. Yeah. When you think about it, it's good. Okay. More Esther parallels. Maybe when we get to the Sidra of Miketz, I'll share with you. A whole litany of parallels between the story. First of all, the characters are very similar. The characters of Joseph and Mordecai are very similar, right? Just look at the obvious similarities, right? How many other Jewish people can you name who became the viceroys of empires in the ancient Near East, right? So the fact that they are so similar in what they did clearly inspired the people who wrote about them to use strikingly similar terms. Just as I tried to argue this evening that the authors and editors of Chronicles presented David's purchase of the threshing floor of Aravna in terms that were deliberately reminiscent of Avraham's acquisition of the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the authors and editors of Megillat Esther, because of the striking similarities that Mordechai bore to Yosef, made a point of telling the story of Mordechai using a considerable number of expressions and phrases that appear only in the story of Yosef. But it's much too much to go through now, and I don't also carry it all upstairs. So it's something to keep in mind when we get to Miketz. And that's pretty much it. So.
Okay. Of course, there's a lot of comparisons between Esther and Yosef too. In other words, the good looks, there's a lot of, even, you know, it's right, the parallels to Mordechai. I mean, that's the whole question with Megillat Esther. It's in Mordechai and Esther, you know, who's the key? It's called Megillat Esther, but the roles of each one. So that's a yes, and Miketz, and of course, that Mikra, I'm sure that's what you're referring to as a whole list of all the language and all
Gabi
the-
Gabi Cohen.
I'm sorry?
Gabi Cohen's.
Yeah. And the that Mikra series has a whole list. That's, but very good. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you next week, Parsha Toldot. And tomorrow morning, the final the series of Archaeology and the Bible with Shuli Mishkin. And tomorrow night, you know, we do it backwards. First, you do the Haftarah, and then we do the Parsha Shavua on Thursday night. Benji Samuels, tomorrow night from Boston area. Yes, what do you want to say?
Yeah, I know you're Canadian.
Okay.
We meeting on Thanksgiving?
Yes. I mean, first of all, Thanksgiving is on Thursday, not on Wednesday. Somebody said that.
My Orthodox Thanksgiving starts at nightfall the day before.
I gotcha. Yeah, so I see no reason not to. We've had classes on Christmas and Thanksgiving. I often find that on holidays, we sometimes get even more people because people don't have to go to work and, you know, and things. No excuse. I know the Rav ended here early to fly home for Thanksgiving dinner. But yeah. So thank you. But yes, class Thanksgiving. What can I say? All right. Any other comments? Anybody wants to unmute themselves? But otherwise, we look forward to seeing you tomorrow at 11, then at 8:30 in the evening. And thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
This morning we had actually a moment of silence at 11 o'clock, which is Armistice Day. On Remembrance Day, as it's called in Canada, they have Veterans Day. So we actually, with our class at 11 o'clock, that's the moment. They have the moment of silence here in Canada. And all the ceremonies begin at 11 o'clock. So we did do whatever. I didn't mention it now, but we did have earlier. Also mentioned earlier, of course, the passing of Jonathan Sacks, which, of course, is the big, impact this week. And what can we say? I'm sure lots, hopefully, people, I mean, they always read us stuff and read it more. We should have happy occasions. But anyways, okay. We look forward to everybody well. And we look forward to seeing you. And like I always say, invite your friends to try class if they haven't already. And we look forward to learning with everybody.